Good morning, and welcome to Dickinson College. We are honored to be hosting this important conference with the University of Maine. I extend a special welcome to my co-panelists, President Kennedy of the University of Maine, and President Mark Guerin, President of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Thank you both for being with us. Now, this is a rather unusual all-day conference. There are actually two agendas going on here simultaneously. One is a sort of smaller ambition, and that is for Dickinson College and the University of Maine to get to know each other better on this topic, our interests, and the possibilities as we move forward, working for some possible larger ambitions. The second is that the general public, interested in the crucial area of public service, has an opportunity to hear this dialogue, engage in this dialogue, and also give us some guidance as we move forward. You will see people coming and going. There are a variety of formats, and there are a variety of opportunities for discussion during the course of the day. We are particularly indebted to Dan and Betty Churchill for not only suggesting the conference, but also supporting it and being with us today. Betty is a graduate of Dickinson, and Dan, I bet you can guess this, is a graduate of the University of Maine. Both have enjoyed long careers in public service. Through their professional commitments, they have firsthand knowledge of the importance of public service to our nation's future, not to mention a lifetime of personal satisfaction such careers afford those who choose to pursue them. They also possess a deep, abiding commitment to attracting young people to careers in public service. I have no doubt that their perspectives and those of others who have followed similar career paths will add great value to our discussion today. Betty and Dan, thank you for being with us. It is, I believe, especially appropriate that we gather today at Dickinson to discuss the future of public service. As many of you know, the college was founded at the close of the American Revolution by Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, for the highest purpose imaginable, to prepare the engaged citizens and leaders who would ensure the success of the new democracy. Rush knew that our new democratic government would demand the active participation of an educated citizenry. For that reason, he established Dickinson College, then on the edge of the western frontier, to provide a useful, and I use his words, useful liberal arts education to enable its students to be informed participants in the new government. And that meant to vote, to participate and lead in community organizations, to speak out on issues that matter in an informed way, and to pursue jobs strategically important to the emerging nation. It is also especially appropriate that we convene this conference just a few short weeks after the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Public service at the community level has, of course, been a defining characteristic of President Obama's career, and his commitment to increase opportunities for public service has always been a central theme of his campaign. Just as Benjamin Rush recognized that active, engaged citizens were essential to American democracy at its outset, President Obama now asks that, quote, we answer a new call to service to meet the challenges of our new century. In light of the extraordinary needs many of our nation's citizens currently face during this turbulent economic time, our topic today assumes a greater sense of urgency. We have titled this conference, What is Wrong with Public Service? A Challenge for Higher Education. This title puts forth two critical issues I believe we need to address. The first is the notion that public service in its current state is seriously broken. By the way, what isn't broken? Our economy, the auto industry, the housing industry, the banking industry, the lending industry, healthcare, and as you shall soon hear, higher education. All right? There is considerable evidence, anecdotal and otherwise, to suggest that careers in public service, despite the rush of enthusiasm during the last election, are not particularly attractive to young people, excepting perhaps those in what are considered the more dramatic areas as State Department, CIA, FBI, and Peace Corps. While avoiding more seemingly mundane positions in management and budget, science and technology, commerce, veterans affairs, and so on, the best and the brightest are drawn to other professions and areas of interest, and many are not maximizing opportunities that can leverage private sector experience for the public good. The second notion is that higher education has a central role to play in encouraging students to pursue avenues of public service. With the legacy of Benjamin Rush looming large above us, not to mention his statue, which is out in front of this building, I wholeheartedly agree that our nation's colleges and universities, both public and private, have a continuing responsibility to educate students about the importance of active citizenship and to give them the opportunity to engage meaningfully in a range of service activities that will give young people the foundation for a lifetime of commitment. A quick perusal of many colleges and university catalogs and websites certainly conveys the impression that preparation for active citizenship is an important priority at these institutions. The language used by these schools is similar, if not interchangeable. I suggest, however, that this defining objective is not explicitly ingrained in the curriculum and the co-curriculum at these institutions. And equally important, that most colleges and universities are not held accountable for graduating active participants in democracy. I assert that it is time for colleges and universities to recommit to the original intention of a distinctively American education. The unifying principle for American education at its origins was preparation for democracy, to prepare young people through a liberal education to participate in an idea larger than themselves. It was also an idea that was both national and global. Dr. Rush's description of Dickinson's curriculum, like Thomas Jefferson's of that of the University of Virginia, offered explicit commentary on how individual courses would contribute to a student's active involvement in democracy. Every course could be justified as useful for participating and perfecting the new government. There was no sympathy for an education that was self-indulgent, that celebrated learning for learning's sake alone, or that just concentrated on a single vocational subject without breadth of study. This was the type of education found in Europe, and it was judged, and I quote, monkish and elite. But America had fought hard to free itself from European practices. There was a nation to build and a government to perfect. There was pragmatism here, and it was towards these noble ends, but real ends, that all education was to be directed. The accountability for a distinctively American education was not solely located in the competence to which students mastered a particular academic subject. This is how accountability has now evolved in America. We're focusing on the academic subjects, but rather the degree to which the course of study permitted students to be active citizens, again, later to vote, to participate, to lead. Our historic and enduring mission is to educate citizens who will participate in an informed way in our form of government. Isn't this the larger objective for which we should be held accountable? Isn't this what we should be measuring as we assess what our students have learned and what we expect of them as accomplished graduates? Sadly, I am afraid that we as a nation and we as educators have lost the sense of dedication to a common goal, to our inheritance. We have never as a sector completely revolted against England. We have yet to live the revolution in American higher education. The notion of a distinctively American education is, however, a rich and deeply ingrained part of our historic legacy that can be revived and refashioned for the contemporary world. Indeed, there are a number of new initiatives on the horizon that ask us to reconsider this historic mandate, and for those, we are greatly thankful. One of these initiatives directly traces its origins to our founding fathers. The proponents of a new national public service academy, like West Point, Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, Coast Guard Academy, assert that they are returning to an idea advocated by President George Washington, to create a national university to prepare young people for citizenship in the new democracy. The intentions of those leading the effort to establish a U.S. Public Service Academy in our own time are admirable and vital to this discussion. A leader of this movement is with us this morning and will be chatting, and will participate again through his engagement in another panel. And my co-panelist, President Mark Guerin, supports this concept, and so I'm sure we'll be hearing from him. I have no doubt that their proposal will continue to spark much-needed debate about and interest in careers in public service. However, to get things heated up in this early morning, I respectfully disagree with the concept of a dedicated public service academy, and I hope we have some lively debate about this proposition and others today. A recent University of Virginia thesis focusing on George Washington's proposal for national education makes it clear that our first president felt strongly that a broad liberal education would create good citizens and thereby contribute to the health and prosperity of the new republic. Writing at a time when there were but a handful of colleges and universities in the nation, and many of them established along the European rather than the emerging American model, Washington felt it was important to provide an opportunity for young people to be schooled in an extensive liberal education that also acquainted them with the principles of law and republican government. Those educated in this fashion were then expected to spread their knowledge throughout the country by returning to their homes and local communities where there were no colleges and universities. In Washington's time, unlike ours today, there was a real question as to whether the new nation would even survive, given the number of people still sympathetic to England and its monarchic form of government. Washington's focus was not so much about preparing young people for specific careers in government, as he was about educating them for a frame of mind, a disposition about democracy. They would then disseminate in all quarters of the new and very fragile nation an understanding of law and republican government to advance its durability. Now, Washington was not the only founding father to propose a national university in the absence of universities throughout the nation in the late 18th century. It may come as a little surprise to learn that it was actually our Dr. Benjamin Rush who first proposed in written form a national university explicitly to train public servants. Rush's university, however, was to focus only on graduate-level studies to offer advanced training to those who would serve in the highest positions of this nation. Rush was passionate about the benefits of a liberal education, as was President Washington. In Rush's model, however, this broad education for a democratic frame of mind would occur at a network of feeder undergraduate colleges, Dickinson being one, that would lay the foundation for specialized advanced study and for a graduate's engagement in all sorts of professions germane for the new polity: law, medicine, teaching, the ministry, and the military. Rush went so far, imagine this, as to suggest that those serving in the most responsible stations, including members of Congress, should be required to receive a degree from this institution. Now, that is somewhat of an undemocratic proposition. Nevertheless, I would suggest that we have here a focus on an institution that perhaps distracts from the broader agenda of making sure that democratic principles permeate this nation and that are not reserved for an elite. Additionally, we also know that those who are pursuing public service, unlike the military, do not compromise or give away for the national cause some of their rights as regular citizens and supersede that with the law of the military. So there is a very different proposition that is going on here. To conclude, I would say that it is our opportunity, through our discussions today, to look at a set of considerations to advance public service in a way that matches original intentions. We have a real opportunity to move back from the craziness of the assessment that asks us to simply make sure that academic knowledge in and of itself is obtained and puts it not in the context of the larger ambition, which is educating for citizenry. We have indeed lost our way on this topic. We also have the possibility, as we look at public service, to make sure that our young people see it as integral to the process of living a life of dedication to something far larger than themselves. And when you get bogged down into what is worthy, which is the pursuit and measurement of the academics, you can lose sight of what the larger proposition happens to be. It is perhaps time for this country to reassert and to master the fact, as the Founding Fathers thought, that basic scientific, verbal, mathematical literacies should be taken care of in the early years of schooling, and that it's for the universities and colleges to get on about the business of creating citizenship and matching that with noble service. Again, thank you for being here. Thank you for engaging this topic. Let me now turn the podium over to Bob Kennedy. Thank you.
Thank you. And on behalf of the University of Maine, I extend my thanks for the warm Dickinson College hospitality and for the opportunity to be here and to participate in this important forum. I believe in the old adage that you're judged by the company you keep, and certainly we're pleased to be associated with this wonderful institution. And thank you, President Durden, for welcoming us so warmly and for your leadership in arranging this important event. Perhaps more than you can imagine on the surface, you, Maine, and the Dickinson College share a common approach to educating students and serving the world around us. And that I think that will become apparent throughout the day today. We also share something else, and that's the wonderful Churchill family. As you've heard, Betty is a Dickinson graduate and Dan is a UMaine alum, and both of our institutions benefit greatly from their generosity and support, and I'm delighted the Churchills have brought us together today to explore this important issue. Dan and Betty, thank you for sponsoring this forum, and thank you for all you do for our institutions and its broader implications for a better nation and society. You will hear later today from my UMaine colleagues, Provost Sue Hunter and Professor Baman Bakhtiari, and Admiral Gregory Johnson, a distinguished UMaine alum who serves on our Board of Visitors. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to make a few introductory remarks. American colleges and universities play a pivotal role in training the nation's citizens, leaders, innovators, public servants, and educators. I don't think any of us here today need convincing of that. In today's economy, a college education is more critical than ever before. Millions of high school students strive for its promise and the benefits it brings to both the individual and, by extension, to our society. Generations of public servants have come from the American system of higher education, and they come from all kinds of institutions, from large state universities to small private colleges. All of us involved in post-secondary education can and should be proud of this contribution to make our society. The broad-based education we provide through our U.S. colleges and universities prepares people for all kinds of careers and avocations, and public service is among the most noble of these pursuits. Historically, academic leaders and institutions have engaged in thinking more broadly about the roles and the responsibilities of universities in addressing issues in their communities, regions, states, and around the world. And over the years, the Clark Forum has examined so many of these serious and even vexing problems facing our globe. And I applaud President Durden and Dickinson College for that leadership role. When President Durden and I first talked about collaborating on this conference, he pointed out that it would be most appropriate to bring together people from Dickinson and UMaine because we represent two very different kinds of institutions organizationally, but at the same time, very similar institutions with regard to our commitment to our students and the society we serve through education, outreach, and the experience we provide our students. If you compare our mission statements and websites, there are amazing similarities. At the same time, organizationally, Dickinson College and the University of Maine are quite distinct. And I'd like to give you a little perspective about our approach to our mission at the University of Maine. Land-grant universities were founded by legislation signed by President Lincoln in 1862 to provide practical education and the benefits of research to the working men and women of the country. Land-grant institutions like UMaine have placed a high priority on providing expert knowledge on major contemporary issues, such as climate change and a sustainable environment, which are good examples in the case of the University of Maine. Last October, UMaine's renowned Climate Change Institute hosted some 400 people at a two-day conference exploring new ways to assess and understand climate change. While this event included scientific discussion, to be sure, it also moved the dialogue to policy and societal impact, and even the associations among climate change, music, and art. Based on the common understanding that climate change is real and that its impact will be felt for generations, we're working to move the discussion to mitigation, adaptation, and opportunity. Wednesday morning of this week, Scientists from the Institute will present Maine's governor with a report, which he requested, on how Maine can and should deal with climate change and what it will mean to our state in the near and long-term future. I think that that's public service at its basic core. I have the very first copy of that report with me, in fact, the only copy as we left Maine yesterday, which came off the press right before we left Maine for Pennsylvania. It's a beautiful publication, but more important than that, it will provide our state's leaders with valuable information that they could only get from the University of Maine. While that's a vivid example, at UMaine we take our mission of practical support to the state and our society seriously, and we're always working on more ways to lend our unique expertise and bring resources in helping solve serious problems that might lead to a brighter future. As you might expect, we have a lot of current activity underway in the fields related to the development of clean, reliable energy sources, again, an area of enormous potential for public service. Professor Habib Dagher is a world leader in developing new structures to harness offshore wind power, for example. Others are working in developing cellulosic ethanol, tidal power, and other ways of more efficiently creating energy in the future. I've stated that at UMaine we have experts who are among the world's leaders in climate change, cellulosic ethanol, and offshore wind power, areas that are among the most important and challenging problems facing our country and our society, public service. In some sense, this orientation toward public service is tightly woven into the fabric of our state. We've been blessed with wonderful leaders throughout history, especially modern history, including Margaret Chase Smith, Bill Cohen, and the currently high-profile Senators Olympia Snow and Susan Collins. And then there's Senator George Mitchell, recently appointed by President Obama as Special Envoy to the Middle East. As Special Envoy to Northern Ireland in the late 90s, Senator Mitchell was largely responsible for the Good Friday Peace Accord that brought an end to decades of fighting in Northern Ireland. Several times I've heard Senator Mitchell describe the efforts in Northern Ireland as 700 days of failure and one day of success. That is what public service is all about as well. I like to think that some of the next generation leaders at this moment in Neville, Boardman, or Little Hall on the UMaine campus, or Denny Hall, the Weiss Center, or Althaus Hall right here at Dickinson are working hard and preparing to make their mark in the world. The recent creation of our School of Policy and International Affairs, or SPIA as we referred to it, directed by Professor Bahman Bakhtiari, who helped organize this conference, responds to the changing state, national, and international imperatives. The most serious public policy issues today all have important international components: climate change, world hunger, poverty, the war on drugs and national security, international public health, and more. All require policymakers to employ global and cross-disciplinary strategies, a stated focus of the Clark Forum. The United States urgently needs professionals in academic training for careers in public policy and international affairs. Globalization adds increasing complexity and significance to many of these issues, and in Maine, and I'm sure in Pennsylvania, this has not escaped the impact of this that we see across America, the society today. Those charged with responsibilities for public policy find themselves buffeted by global economics and political forces and trends unseen a generation ago. They need perspectives and capabilities that prepare them for understanding public policy in an increasingly interdependent world. In the busy society we live in, we've become familiar with bulleted documents and even top 10 lists. It's sort of the non-academic equivalent when students ask, what do I really need to know for the test? Here's my short list of things that might be considered important for expanding opportunities and service in the public sector. Preparing students for careers in public service is a national priority. As of December 2006, the federal government employed 1,850,000 civil servants. However, the Partnership for Public Service warns of the federal brain drain, pointing to the fact that 44% of federal workers who will become eligible to retire over the next 5 years, creating a need to hire nearly 193,000 new workers for mission-critical jobs. So my list of things to consider, with great input from Professor Bakhtiari, are the following. One, Most service programs have mandatory time commitments. Teach for America asks for 2 years, and for the full AmeriCorps Education Award, one must participate full-time for a year. Service durations ranging from a few weeks to a few months would allow students to turn a boring summer or winter break into a productive experience without interrupting their studies during the school year. After all, and we see this especially at our university, so common in some academic disciplines, usually last only for part or all of a summer. And an estimated 80% of students end up working at the company where they interned. They think of what that could mean for students participating in summer or semester internships in public service. Incentives must also radically change to cater to the differing needs of an expanding volunteer pool. Currently, the annual $5,000 AmeriCorps Education Award is not nearly enough to make a sizable impact on leftover education loans. Forgiveness programs, even tax incentive programs, need to be expanded to accommodate more students' needs. Additional scholarship for college students in exchange for volunteer work, which is public service after all, might help offset the cost of a college education. A Roosevelt Scholars Bill, which would create a scholarship program to encourage graduate students to pursue careers in the federal government, is pending in the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Education and Labor. Universities and colleges can and should do more to encourage public service. We should better inform students about opportunities in government and seek funding directed at helping students pay for the education if they are interested in pursuing public service careers. Faculty members can also play a role in support of students who are interested in public service. Students often look to faculty members for career advice. Tailoring outreach and opportunities for academic disciplines could make a big difference in creating first and lasting impressions on students. Alumni offices can and do host receptions for university alums working in the public service sector, and perhaps more could be done through a college or university's use of its volunteers. Universities should periodically conduct a curriculum inventory of courses and programs to assure updated courses with a policy focus, along with internship programs in Washington, D.C. UMaine did such an inventory recently, and the results were surprising and influential on our academic programs. In fact, this review was instrumental in leading to the creation of our School of Policy and International Affairs, with Dan Churchill as chair of the advisory board and Professor Bakhtiari as its current director. Lastly, it is laudable that some have suggested that we should have a public service academy modeled after military academies. One of the issues that needs to be considered as this proposal is debated is whether America needs a similarly elite public service institution when there are so many fine public policy, education, and law enforcement programs offered in hundreds of colleges and universities. Military academies make sense because only military personnel can really teach those disciplines, and the model might work equally well eventually with a public service academy. Regardless, public service should be integrated fully into current university programming. There is no higher calling than public service, and we are at a unique and exciting juncture. Demand for educated, dedicated, prepared public servants is high and will remain high. As we speak, political, economic, social, and public health events around the world cry out for more individuals educated, trained, and dedicated to this work. I couldn't help but be struck by President Durden's eloquent call for increased public service in America's colleges and universities. If, as you did, as I did, you Google public service, what comes up is public utility companies. I think the fact that when you do that and you don't get public service in the context that we're talking about it this morning, there's more that needs to be done and more education and more discipline and dedication to the work of public service. We can all, including and perhaps especially land-grant universities, do more and better to apply our unique resources to answering the challenge that we have addressed today. Thank you, and thank you for hosting this wonderful event.
Thank you, Mark.
And now, President Guerin.
Good morning, and President Durden, thank you very much for the nice invitation to be here at Dickinson College. President Durden is known well within the liberal arts college community, certainly as a leader in higher education. We appreciate your work on all of our part. I am pleased to be here, certainly President Kennedy and President Durden following their really interesting and thought-provoking remarks. I have to compliment the organizers of this symposium and this conference for starting out the morning with three college and university presidents within 45 minutes time. We're not known for this skill. I'm reminded of the very bad joke of college presidents. You know, when it's been a while that you've been a college president, when you're sitting at breakfast with your children and you eating your Cheerios and you stand up, button your coat, and say, "Thank you very much for having me here." But thank you very much for having me here. I am pleased to be here, and like others, grateful to Betty and Dan Churchill for their important initiative in putting this conference together and their support for this, as well as my gratitude to the members of the faculty and leadership of Maine and Dickinson for really pulling together a very interesting and timely topic. With so many folks from Maine and Nick Burns coming, it's nice to be here at Red Sox Nation, I think Carlisle style. But with scholars like Stanley Katz and advocates like Chris Myers Ash and public service exemplars like Nick Burns, this day that you have planned is a important one and a timely one with this topic. I offer my reflections as currently a college president. I had served as director of the Peace Corps, and I currently serve on the board of the Corporation for National Community Service. So my comments reflect those perspectives and my passion for this topic and interest in the work that y'all are doing. The timing, I think, is especially critical because I see some very interesting and, frankly, encouraging convergence of factors that allow us to think carefully about the topics that you've laid out and make this subject all the more compelling for policymakers in Washington and beyond. Number one, I have seen, certainly from my time at the Peace Corps and at the Corporation, a growing interest in service, community service, among undergraduates across the nation. Many young Americans wanting to give back to their community, which I believe has great implications for the broader topic of public service. Secondly, there is, as President Durden said, a new administration in Washington that has captured certainly the imagination of so many young Americans and has recruited and brought to Washington a highly talented, technologically sophisticated cadre of leaders and managers into the administration at a time of great economic turmoil, which will, I think, have implications for our topic. And third, there are compelling demographic realities about the federal government workforce that President Kennedy referenced that I believe force our focus and force an expansion of some of the ideas, including the Public Service Academy, that I think prompt us to think well beyond and out of the box for radical ideas, given the enormity of the challenge, given the pressures that exist, and given the compelling evidence that I think exists in Washington and beyond about the federal workforce and the needs. So these three areas, I think, converge to give me encouragement, frankly, for the topic we're discussing, but a particular responsibility for those of us in higher education, from universities to colleges. So let me unpack these three points. First, as I said, I think there is this growing ethic of service in our country, one that certainly on this great campus you see imbued with a revolutionary spirit that is a great part of Dickinson's legacy and continues today with an impressive amount of outreach and civic engagement on this campus. The Corporation for National Community Service conducted a survey, comprehensive survey in 2007, and found great encouragement for many more Americans making time to improve their communities through service. 29% regularly volunteer in our country. Significantly, though, underneath that statistic, what has happened is the great growth within that percentage is among young adults aged 16 to 19, having doubled between 1989 and 2006. So this cohort group moving through the system has a great deal of interest in community service, and I think those of us on college and university campuses see that being played out when they arrive on our campuses. You see it in the work of Campus Compact, an organization of college and university presidents now 20-plus years old that has over 1,000 college and university presidents who are committed to service and service learning and civic engagement. And I think we see it in the growth of interest in the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps and Teach for America, City Year, all of the organizations that have sprung up over the past, and some recent ones, 10 to 15 years and beyond. So this interest in service is one that should be nurtured, should be encouraged by campuses, and our responsibility in the classroom and outside the classroom. Secondly, the new administration. In his inaugural address, President Obama ushered in what he called a new era of responsibility. And his language and his approach, his call to action and call to service, is one that I think comes at a very important time in regard to the topic we're discussing here today, to foster and enhance respect for and interest in public service. Again, President Durden spoke to this in terms of the moment for the Obama administration and the unique capacity that his administration will have to move us forward. Relatedly, Stanley Katz and I last night at dinner were discussing the economic times, which I think is also a converging point here. The recession, the economic turmoil that we live in, will also force a recalibration among all of us as Americans and young Americans on their career choices, a reexamination of them, perhaps, of what it means to have a life of consequence. Again here, colleges and universities have an enormous responsibility and duty for the public good that is very much part of our mission central work to advance this inquiry of our students and to advance the opportunities and profile our graduates along the lines of President Kennedy has outlined for what colleges and universities can do to both expose current students to career choices and to encourage them to contemplate and to think about what kind of life will be meaningful to them and how they can make a difference. And the third converging factor I would offer is that the demographic realities, which are fierce and important, and every citizen should be prompted by and motivated by, and perhaps allow a fresh look at ideas, creative ideas, like the Public Service Academy. Let me review some of this. It's well known to many in this room, certainly, but the federal government will need to hire thousands of people over the next several years. One-third of its workforce is expected to retire in the next 5 years. One-third. And the government demands for skilled workers, particularly in technology or in scientific areas, is enormous. For the past 20 years or so, a group, Universum USA, has done surveys among college students. Last year, the Partnership for Public Service that I've been involved with partnered with them in their 2008 survey and revealed some very interesting statistics in terms of approaches to government service, and let me review them for you. When asked out of 46 options, what is the most popular industry choice among young people, government and public service was listed as the most important choice, 17%. The next was 13% for healthcare, 12% for education, and 11% for marketing and advertising. So we come into this conversation with a great deal of interest on the part of undergraduates and young Americans with an interest in government and public service. Relatedly, in the survey, 5 of the top 15 ideal employers from a list of 260 were federal agencies, the State Department, NASA, Peace Corps, the CIA, and the FBI as 5 ideal employers. Students in this survey found that the reputation of the employers was a critical factor as they considered career choices. Obviously, there was salary expectations that may have been higher than public service would have allowed for. But what is striking to me in this point of this survey is the grounding of interest that exists in public service, as evidenced by this survey. And when you match that with the times that we live in, the opportunity for the Obama administration, and for what we are seeing on college campuses with students coming in imbued with a sense of giving back, this is a natural outgrowth. Colleges and universities have a particular responsibility, certainly, and the ideas that President Kennedy outlined in terms of incentives for forgiving loans and expanding that are all important ones. And last, I close with a wonderful excerpt from President Woodrow Wilson's inaugural address when he was inaugurated as the president of Princeton. We like to quote college presidents who then become the real president, of course. But in his address called Princeton for the Nation's Service, he said the following: American universities have a character and service of their own. They are not mere seminaries of scholars. Their task is twofold: the production of great body of informed and thoughtful citizens, and the production of a small body of trained scholars and investigators. These two functions are not to be performed separately, but side by side, and are to be informed with one spirit, the spirit of enlightenment, a spirit of learning, of which is neither superficial nor pedantic, which values life more than it values the mere acquisitions of the mind. Those of us in higher education have a great opportunity to contribute to the revitalization of our nation's civic life, and it's my hope that this conference and the conversations here can advance many ideas to reinforce our progress and perhaps lay out an ambitious agenda for the future. Thank you for having me.
We have just a few minutes before we go to the next session, and I do have a few collegial presidents here, just a few questions that I'd like to pose. Firstly, and they're related, I think, what do you believe college and university presidents can do to, in a pragmatic way, to move this agenda of increased public service along, especially in a context in which, for decades, many have basically not wanted to hear from college presidents. They have said that we should not be speaking out about things that we don't know about at all, and they would probably include public service in that. So do we have an opportunity? Have the times changed? Now, that's related to another very sensitive issue that has gotten a lot of play recently, and that is the landscape changing, and college and universities aren't completely aware of it? I mean, obviously, I think we are here, but if you look across the country, for example, you're beginning to hear a groundswell of a protest of why isn't ROTC on campuses across the country? This is a part of public service. Well, why shouldn't we have citizen soldiers? Isn't that appropriate? There was a period, of course, CIA, FBI, that's a keep them away. Don't let them near the academy. And yet, if you go back to some of the points I was trying to establish, that was our original intent. It was not the monkish British way, all due respect to those from Britain here. But we love you dearly. But we're different. But the issue is, what do you think our options are here? Are we standing in the way as a sector of our young people moving into careers that will be satisfying for them?
Do you want me to start? Sure. I think we're standing in the way in some ways, in that we're not fully taking advantage of some of the opportunities that college and university presidents have, I think. It used to be consequential what college and university presidents said. U.S. presidents consulted with college and university presidents on topics. Growing up, it was important what Kingman Brewster would say, or Derek Bach would go off to California for a month and write a paper on an interesting topic, and it was page one of the New York Times. A lot has been written on this and studied, certainly, of the role of the modern college and university president. My own view is I think the common limitation that is frequently raised, that is the fundraising duties of a president, may be a convenient cop-out for many leaders. While it is an important and valuable and necessary part of one's duties, I do believe there are opportunities for presidents to be engaged in civic life and reflecting on topics of national importance, particularly at a time when so much of U.S. society is under such derision or broken, from the corporate sector to the public sector, to religious communities. There needs to be, I think, for young people, a sense of optimism and idealism. Secondly, I think we need to look hard, and President Kennedy, I think, did a nice job at looking at some specific things that we could do on campuses, from loan forgiveness to the public policy implications of this, to working with alumni and alumni relation offices, to our use of work-study funds, which, of course, is the holy grail of colleges and universities, and a controversial topic of what is the percentage that we allocate for work-study dollars towards the public good. We all, frankly, enjoy and benefit from use of those student aid dollars to run our libraries, to perform services in college and universities. But I think if we're honest with each other and to ourselves, one has to explore what opportunities could be better utilized to advance the public good, as our mission indicates, and utilize these public resources in a more affirmative way.
Thank you. Bob?
I'm struck by the comments that on the work study dollars, and part of the stimulus package does include, in fact, monies for work study. And wouldn't it have been remarkable had they been proposed to be used for fostering and facilitating public service? They were just not thrown out there, but they're out there undesignated. But wouldn't that have been great had they been designated for a specific cause which the country so desperately needs? Again, picking up on comments already made, I think college and university presidents, there was a time when they were more active, more proactive in helping to shape and inform public opinion. And there has been a tendency to get away from that some. I think one of the most important things that could be done, and I'm frequently reminded of this on the campus, is that university presidents, I think, have a real role in espousing and being seen as advocates for certain causes. So I think one of the things that we can do, more importantly than anything else, is to talk about, to reflect, to illustrate the importance of public service on our campus. And that alone would have a big impact for faculty and the academic community.
You never get full agreement, as Mark and I fully know from the Annapolis group. You never get, about 125 liberal arts colleges, and Mark chairs, is delighted to chair that right now. But nevertheless, we seldom get agreement of all our institutions and all the presidents. But there is an emerging concept that I'm hearing more and more people ask me, well, I support this, well, I get behind this. And that is somewhat the German notion in other countries. It's the national service. Following your university study, and that is either military or public service. And do you think there is any possibility that we could see our colleagues getting behind this in a broader way, to have that pause? You know, we're living a life, we keep hearing this. There's a terrific book that just came out talking about the years 1900 to 1910 called The Vertigo Years. Speed, 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 speed. That's all it is. And that characterized the lifestyle, so reminiscent of today, so reminiscent. And, of course, there was a shattering of the world after 1910, around 1914. But nevertheless, could this introduction, given major support by college and university presidents, of a year or two of universal public service be something that slows down our world and gives us, again, a point of reflection? Do you think we can get presidents behind that?
Perhaps. It's an unruly group. I have to say my own thinking is evolving on the topic because of the potential that exists and the great interest that exists on so many young people to, in a meaningful way, give back to community. When I was director of the Peace Corps, we had 10,000 applications for 3,500 positions. Now, I'm not suggesting that the balance were all tan, fit, and ready to be Peace Corps volunteers, but certainly our limitation was only for funding. And of the foreign assistance budget, which we know is 1%, Peace Corps is 1% of that 1%. I had all the lines for Congress. It was less than the military marching bands, and I like the military marching bands. But it's a remarkably small number. Same thing for AmeriCorps. So the interest is there. organizationally, it's an extraordinary task. Even seeing the growth of AmeriCorps, which is now very large indeed, and a pride point, I believe, for our country. But there could be, in models perhaps, as President Kennedy suggests, shorter-term assignments, short of a year. We think of these things only in an academic, agrarian economy kind of way from August to August. Perhaps there could be other ways to fashion this that might allow for it. At the very least, what one would want to do is fully fund AmeriCorps Incorporation, fully fund the Peace Corps, so you would absolutely capture the growth of interest in service.
Thank you.
You posed the question of could this happen, or could it be supported by college and university presidents? I'm generally known as always the optimist, but I'm not so sure I would be as optimistic on this point. I think it's a good point. In my experience in higher education, there are always the pendulum shifts, and I think as has been stated, the pendulum shift right now is a little bit more toward students being interested in public service. So there may be an opportune time right now for that. And I think it's a very worthy, and it would be an enormously noble cause if we could rally university presidents. I think it would be worth a try, quite frankly. A statistic I saw in thinking about this conference and the topic recently, and it illustrates that pendulum shift, but about 20 to 30% of Harvard students, not to pick on Harvard, but about 20 to 30% of Harvard students aspire to be on Wall Street. That has changed and probably will continue to change. But as we think about the interests of young people, I think it may be very opportune and timely right now, and certainly I think an awful lot of university presidents would very willingly and quickly get behind this. So perhaps the time has come for us to pick up that mantle and support the concept, because surely there's been very few times in the history of this country or the world where that kind of service is more needed than right now.
Thank you, President Guerin and President Kennedy. Again, this was intended simply to frame the issues from the President's point of view, and now we'll dig down into some of the topics during the course of the day, and I believe have a very lively interaction, and we hope come out at a point where there are next steps for action, taking many of the good plans on the table and moving them forward. Thank you very much. I think there'll be just a little pause, and we'll rearrange, and we'll be all set. Thank you.